Welcome to VOA Asia Weekend. Over the next 60 minutes, you'll hear some of the top stories and features of the past week from our daily VOA Asia program. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington.
Democrats formally nominated former Vice President Joe Biden as their candidate for president Tuesday during the second night of an extraordinary virtual convention that included criticism of President Donald Trump from Republicans as well as Democrats, and personal stories of Biden as a public servant, father, and husband. VOA White House correspondent Patsy Whitaker-Suara has more from Wilmington, Delaware.
I have always loved
capping the second night of the Democratic National Convention. The woman who could be the next First Lady, Jill Biden, highlighted the pandemic's impact on children and families and spoke of her husband from a high school classroom where she used to teach in the Biden's hometown of Wilmington, Delaware.
How do you make a broken family whole? The same way you make a nation whole. With love and understanding, and with small acts of kindness.
Just as on the first night, Republicans lined up to support Biden, including Colin Powell, the retired four-star general and Secretary of State under President George W. Bush, who said Joe Biden would make a responsible commander-in-chief.
For Joe Biden, that doesn't need teaching. It comes from the experience he shares with millions of military families, sending his beloved son off to war and praying to God he would come home safe.
Their presence highlights the white tent message of unity that Democrats want to convey, targeting moderate Republicans and independents. But ideology is not the only divide the Democrats are seeking to bridge.
They focus on another divide, the generational gap, where old guards share the spotlight with young rising stars.
You know what Donald Trump will do with four more years? Blame, bully, and belittle. And you know what Joe Biden will do? Build back better.
We stand with Joe Biden because this isn't just about defeating Donald Trump. We are in this to win for America.
And the great state of Alabama cast 52 votes.
Everything is done virtually, including the traditional roll call, where delegates cast their votes based on the result of each state's primary or caucus.
We're going to look back on this and call it the Zoom convention, because I think some of the moments that might have seemed awkward or might have seemed like the picture was a little grainy, I think that's part of many of our lived experience now. And more to the point, is in fact how we are having relationships in some cases with coworkers, family members, people that we care about.
On Wednesday night, the Democratic National Convention will continue with California Senator Kamala Harris delivering her acceptance speech as the vice presidential nominee, making history as the first Black woman and South Asian American on a national U.S. political ticket. From Wilmington, Delaware, Patsy Whitaker-Suara, VOA News.
A resounding message.
President Donald Trump said he did not want to deal with China now and that canceling the trade deal was a possibility. Answering a reporter's question during his Yuma, Arizona visit, Trump appeared to be making the statement over China's handling of the coronavirus, as well as using the opportunity to take a shot at Joe Biden.
U.S.-China talks were postponed. You were supposed to have a review of this trade deal.
I postponed them. I postponed talks with China. You know why? I don't want to deal with them now. I don't want to deal with them now. With what they did to this country and to the world, I don't want to talk to China right now, okay?
Are you going to pull out of the trade deal?
We'll see what happens. Look, let me tell you, what China did to the world was not even thinkable. They could have stopped it. They stopped it from going into China, and they should have stopped it. So that's correct. I canceled talks with China.
President,
by the way, Sleepy Joe Biden never got in. China would own the United States. They'd own it. They'd own every one of these people. They'd own this building. They'd own the United States because Biden would give them everything for two reasons. Number one, he's not smart. And number two, he's weak. China would own our country.
Trump was in Arizona for a briefing on the construction of the border wall, where he repeated a key campaign promise from 4 years ago that Mexico would ultimately pay for the wall's construction. Taiwan said Wednesday that China was behind cyber attacks and an infiltration aiming to steal important data from the government. Edward Baran reports.
Taiwan said on Wednesday that hacking groups linked to the Chinese government had attacked at least 10 government agencies and thousands of email accounts of government officials to steal important data. Taiwan has been urging its people to be alert for what officials call omnipresent infiltration from China. That includes Beijing-backed media campaigns and cyber attacks against the island that China considers its territory. Liu Chai-zung from Taiwan's Investigation Bureau said some of the IP addresses used are those connected to mainland hacking groups, and that they were aiming to acquire important government documents and data. Liu's office said it had not been able to identify what data was stolen as the hackers concealed their tracks.
Reuters' Edward Baran.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. With VOA Asia, also follow radio program hosts VOA Stevenson and VOA Melman. VOA Asia Twitter. We're always online for you. We're back with more VOA Asia Weekend. Here's Ira Melman.
In an effort to woo passengers into flying again, U.S. Airlines announced they are taking some new steps to protect travelers from the coronavirus. This comes as the number of people flying has once again decreased. Airlines such as Delta recently posted a nearly $6 billion loss for the second quarter. Many airlines are encouraging employees to retire early to reduce the need for layoffs in October when federal payroll aid expires. More from VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo.
Airlines have been trying to assure a frightened public that flying is safe and won't expose them to the coronavirus. But people are still not convinced as the number of confirmed cases in the U.S. surpassed 5.4 million this week and more than 170,000 have died from the illness. Delta Airlines flight attendant Jason Bond says he's never seen anything like this in his 23-year career.
I've been through SARS, bird flu, all those different flus that have come out, 9/11. You know, I think this is even worse than if you talk to other pilots and flight attendants, this is worse than 9/11.
Industry experts say air travel has not picked up as it should, even after a few months of gradual increase. Last week, the number of people passing through U.S. airports fell for the first time since April. Airline executives cited a resurgence in reported coronavirus infections as a reason for the decline.
No matter how much time it takes, we will always go through the cleaning process and make sure the cleaning specs are met. And if that means that we will compromise an on-time departure so that our aircraft are clean, we will do just that.
Delta recently announced additional health screenings for passengers who say they cannot wear a mask for health reasons before being allowed to board a plane.
We want to ensure that our customers and our employees feel safe and coming to work and being in an airport environment that's clean and disinfected and knowing that we're taking every precaution possible.
United Airlines said it will increase the flow of air through filtration systems during boarding and deplaning, which it said would make the air cleaner than in restaurants and grocery stores. To create more space between passengers, Delta, Southwest, and JetBlue are keeping some seats open, even if it's not the 2 meters of social distancing that health experts recommend. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
Are my pets safe from coronavirus? There's no current evidence that cats and dogs can be infected. Hand washing after contact with all animals is recommended. This protects against other bacteria such as E. coli and Salmonella that can pass between animals and humans. For more information, visit the websites at the World Health Organization and the U.S. Centers for Disease and Control. A message from your friends at VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us for VOA Asia Weekend.
Many countries, school administrators, and families are facing the troubling problem of when and how to reopen schools. Opening up the schools with a lingering COVID danger is a difficult challenge. Saba Shah Khan tries to find out if the parents, students, and schools are ready.
Only a few weeks left of the summer vacation, but in some ways, it feels like an extension of the school shutdowns that happened all across the United States in March.
There's more family time, but for school, it's just weird not getting like seeing the friends face to face.
The school break has been unique for this generation, but as the new school year is set to begin, the questions now are, when is it safe for kids to go back to school, or is virtual learning the way to go?
Sending kids to a setup where social distancing could not be followed, where a lot of kids from different families will come together, sounds risky. And as a parent and a doctor, I feel that should be the last step.
While Arnav is looking forward to seeing his friends, he's also afraid of bringing the virus home.
I'm scared of my family dying, like my elder people.
Chavi and her husband are both physicians. Because they work with COVID patients, the couple had a hard time finding babysitters during the summer break. According to a report by McKinsey & Company, 26.8 million people, that is 16% of the American workforce, depends on schools and childcare so they can work.
The fact is that schools and preschools play an important role in the U.S. economy. As per the National Center for Education Statistics, more than 56.6 million students will attend primary, middle, and high schools across the country.
But with uncertainty about the spread of the virus, many school districts are looking for the safest option to reopen while ensuring that children move ahead with their learning. The decision lies with many of America's 98,000 school superintendents.
A lot of our teachers and a lot of our parents are asking for a virtual option. There's differing opinions on what's acceptable as far as social distancing space between 3 feet and 6 feet, and whether we can have congregate eating or sports contact or anything of the like.
The lack of funding and resources poses a challenge for other school districts with limited resources. Harris's district has 1,000 students. 300 do not have computers at home, while 40 don't have access to the internet. There's also worry about the economic impact of not opening schools.
Well, if we shutter schools, now parents are home with their kids and that they can't go to work. And now the food lines get longer and longer and longer.
Despite all the uncertainty and stress, these high school students found joy, even though they graduated months behind schedule.
We're thankful that we can have a graduation. Obviously, it's not the ideal situation, but we're making the most of it.
The students are still hopeful, despite the pandemic. Saba Shah Khan, VOA News, Voorhees, New Jersey.
New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern hit back against U.S. President Donald Trump for saying her country is experiencing a big surge in COVID-19. Libby Hogan reports.
New Zealand's leader Jacinda Ardern hit back at U.S. President Donald Trump on Tuesday for saying New Zealand was in the grip of, quote, a terrible upsurge in COVID-19 cases.
Obviously, I don't think there's any comparison between New Zealand's current cluster and the tens of thousands of cases that are being seen daily in the United States.
Trump's comments have started an uproar in New Zealand. Just 13 new infections were confirmed in New Zealand on Tuesday, taking the tally of infections to nearly 1,300 since the pandemic began, whereas the United States have recorded more than 5 million cases. After brushing off any parallel between the two countries, Ardern added that she doubted people would be fooled by Trump's comments.
Look, I think for anyone who's following COVID and its transmission globally, will quite easily see that New Zealand's 9 cases in a day does not compare to the United States tens of thousands, and in fact does not compare to most countries in the world. I'm not concerned about people misinterpreting our status.
New Zealand has fared far better than most countries during the pandemic, but an abrupt resurgence of COVID-19 last week in its biggest city, Auckland, prompted the government to extend a lockdown.
That was Reuters' Libby Hogan reporting. Federal officials are facing a parliamentary committee over a cruise ship scandal that fueled Australia's coronavirus crisis. More than 2,500 passengers were allowed to leave the Ruby Princess without being tested after a docked in Sydney in March, despite suspected COVID-19 cases on board. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The Ruby Princess was the source of one of Australia's biggest coronavirus clusters. It led to 28 deaths and more than 1,000 infections across the country and overseas. Senior officials from Australia's Border Force and Agriculture Department, which had staff on board the cruise liner, are expected to face tough questions from lawmakers in Canberra. They're investigating how and why 2,650 passengers weren't tested for the virus despite suspected cases on board. After completing an 11-day cruise to New Zealand, travellers were allowed to disembark at Sydney Harbour and catch public transport and domestic and overseas flights home. A parliamentary committee was set up in April to examine the government's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. It's due to complete its final report in June 2022. A separate New South Wales inquiry into the Ruby Princess has blamed state health authorities for inexcusable mistakes. They had declared the ship to be low risk, but the inquiry found they should have tested sick patients immediately. A police investigation into the scandal continues. New South Wales State Premier Gladys Berejiklian says monumental mistakes were made.
Can I now apologise unreservedly to anybody who suffered as a result of the mistakes that were outlined in the report undertaken by individuals within the health department? Not only have lessons been learned, but clearly those circumstances should and will never happen again in New South Wales.
Following the Ruby Princess debacle, about a dozen other cruise liners were banned from docking at Australian ports due to the risk of spreading the coronavirus. Australia has had about 23,500 confirmed coronavirus cases. More than 420 people have died. The centre of the public health crisis is the state of Victoria. It recorded 222 new cases Tuesday and 17 deaths. State Premier Daniel Andrews has previously described COVID-19 as a cunning and wicked enemy. For VOA News, Phil Mercer, Sydney.
After you listen to VOA Asia, see it. VOA Asia is on YouTube. See and share the fun with Food Bites, our weekly culinary dive into foods from the homeland. Recipes that came with chefs who immigrated to the United States. Students enrolling in U.S. schools can get their first lessons about life on campus. Subscribe for free and see us often on VOA Asia YouTube. You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. There's much more right after this.
How to stay healthy. Wash your hands with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. Scrub thoroughly for 20 seconds. If you cannot wash your hands, use a hand sanitizer. Taking these steps can prevent not only coronavirus, but also colds and flu and other viruses.
New Zealand's general election due next month has been postponed for 4 weeks because of a spike in coronavirus cases. The Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, says the new date on 17 October gives parties the opportunity to plan their campaigns around any COVID-19 restrictions. In Australia, the state of emergency has been extended as the state of Victoria records another grim milestone. More than 400 people have died from the virus in Australia, 22 in New Zealand. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern had been under increasing pressure to delay an election due in September. Most campaigning has been halted by a spike in coronavirus cases in Auckland, which is under a two-week lockdown. Ardern says polling day will now be on October 17.
Moving an election date, especially this late in the electoral cycle, is a significant decision. Our resurgence plan is in full swing. There are high levels of testing, rapid contact tracing, alongside the level 3 restrictions that are all designed to limit the spread of the current cluster. However, it is clear that the re-emergence of COVID in Auckland at the beginning of the formal campaign period has been cause for concern.
The source of the infections is still a mystery. New Zealand's main opposition National Party had argued the election should be delayed until November or even into next year. They believe restrictions on campaigning because of the pandemic would give the Prime Minister an unfair advantage. Jacinda Ardern had been widely praised for crushing the virus and is expected to win another term. But her opponents hope she will lose some of her lustre once hardships caused by the Auckland lockdown begin to bite. Across the Tasman Sea, Australia has recorded its deadliest day of the pandemic so far. 25 people have died in the state of Victoria in the past day. 282 new coronavirus cases have been reported, prompting some optimism by disease experts. Professor Jodie McVernon, the Director of Epidemiology at the Doherty Institute in Melbourne, says daily infection rates in Victoria are going down.
We've obviously been in a situation just a few weeks ago where we were seeing numbers in the 700s. Those numbers are now coming down into the 200s or maybe around 300. And with that, we're seeing fewer numbers of contacts of cases being reported. We're seeing less clusters and outbreaks being reported. And overall, the number of healthcare worker infections are coming down. And all of those are really positive indicators.
Victoria has also extended a state of emergency for another month. The city of Melbourne remains in lockdown and other restrictions apply across the entire state. Organisers of Sydney's New Year's Eve fireworks are under increasing pressure to cancel the famous display because of the pandemic. The city of Melbourne could also lose the rights to host the Australian Rules Football Grand Final, the nation's biggest sporting event, in October because of the COVID-19 crisis. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
South Korea, which had effectively contained one of the world's first coronavirus outbreaks, is seeing a COVID-19 resurgence, with officials warning the country could be on the verge of another large-scale eruption. I talked about it with VOA Seoul correspondent Bill Gallo.
What we're seeing in Seoul is 4 consecutive days of new infections of coronavirus in the triple digits, which may not sound like a lot compared to many countries, but for South Korea, it's quite significant. You know, the numbers that they had seen on a daily basis before that was something like 20 or 30 new cases a day. It was a very manageable level. And so starting 4 days ago, we started to see this pick up. And it got up to near 300 cases yesterday. This is concerning because most of the infections they're seeing are in the Seoul metropolitan area. It's very densely populated, of course. It's where over half of South Korea's population lives, and it really hasn't been impacted very much by the earlier infections you saw in February and March in South Korea. So authorities are actually concerned that because of the nature of these infections, and it's not just one cluster infection, it's many, many cluster infections, that this may actually be a more dangerous situation than what this country saw back in the early spring.
Was there or is there a situation that a particular church is being blamed for this?
The most dangerous cluster infection that we've seen was at a Presbyterian church in the Seoul metropolitan area. This is a mega church, like very many mega churches there are in the Seoul area, that have continued to meet. This particular church is led by a controversial right-wing pastor who involves himself in politics quite a bit. He has accused the government here of many things, but most recently he's accused the government of intentionally falsifying the test results, the coronavirus test results of his church members. About 300 of them so far have tested positive. And as of tonight, actually, that pastor has tested positive. This is notable because over the weekend, he held a very large, or he attended a very large political rally with many of his congregants. Authorities are trying to track down people who attended that unauthorized protest to sort of make sure everyone's tested and you know, they can do the contract tracing there.
Are lockdowns coming again?
Yes, they have actually increased the social distancing measures, which is quite a shame because, you know, we had really figured this out, it felt like, in South Korea. Life had, in a lot of ways, returned to normal. There were even fans at baseball games. Of course, the fans weren't, you know, completely filling the stadiums, but they were increasing it every few weeks. And now there will be no fans at baseball stadiums. They have banned indoor gatherings of more than 50 people and outdoor gatherings of more than 100 people. They also say that more restrictions could be on the way if these numbers don't stabilize.
The pandemic has had an effect on the planned military exercises as well.
That's right. So in a couple of ways, they've affected the exercises. The main way is that the U.S. and South Korean troops, which are starting these exercises on Tuesday, will only be doing online training. They will not be doing sort of these field exercises. That doesn't happen every year at this particular exercise, but I think there was a sense that they wanted to do that in part because of the earlier exercises in the spring that were canceled because of coronavirus. These exercises have already been scaled back for a while because of Donald Trump actually scaling them back in order to make room for diplomacy with North Korea. So it's a situation where I think you have a lot of experts who are concerned that perhaps U.S. and South Korean soldiers who rotate in and out of their mission here in Korea will not have had sort of that hands-on field training that they have had for years as a result of these scaled-back exercises.
Now, North Korea has reacted to these military exercises in the past. Do you think a scaled-down military exercise will alleviate that?
I think we can only sort of just wait and see on that. North Korea seems to get upset about things whenever it wants to get upset about things, it seems like to me. But it is definitely notable, as you say, they have very often gotten upset at these exercises in the past, even when they've been scaled back. So it would not be surprising to see in the next week some sort of response from North Korea.
Bill Gallo is our Seoul correspondent for VOA. Bill, once again, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook. VOA Asia is also on Twitter and YouTube. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, read, and share all the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news, information, and great features. We're back with more VOA Asia Weekend.
Thank you for being with us. Ahead of an upcoming release of Taliban detainees held in Afghan prisons, the insurgent group warned the government in Kabul against any attack on those released, saying such incidents would jeopardize the peace talks. A Taliban spokesman told the Associated Press there have been at least 11 such attacks in the past several months, instances when freed Taliban figures were killed, harassed, and rearrested by government forces. Kabul officials deny unwarranted attacks on free Taliban. The prisoner release is part of a deal the insurgents signed with the United States earlier this year. A Taliban prisoner release may have hit a snag as several countries, including France, have expressed opposition to the release of some hardcore Taliban fighters. I spoke with Michael Kugelman, the senior associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center think tank in Washington, about what has led up to these latest developments.
Back at the end of February, the U.S. government concluded an agreement with the Taliban that essentially led to the formation of a withdrawal schedule for U.S. forces. But one of the other features of that agreement was a Taliban prisoner release agreement, in which essentially the Afghan government would release 5,000 Taliban prisoners in its custody. At the same time, you were going to have, the idea was for the Taliban to release some Afghan prisoners. But the main thing here is we were talking about 5,000 Taliban prisoners in the custody of the Afghan government. Now, what was controversial about this is that was an arrangement that came out of a negotiation that did not involve the Afghan government. It involved only the U.S. government and the Taliban. And so, essentially, the Afghan government was put in a position where it had to make a very difficult decision as to whether it could afford, in terms of security, to release so many Taliban prisoners, including several hundred that, according to the Afghan government, had been convicted of murder and all kinds of terrible things. But eventually what happened was that the Afghan government concluded that if it was to have any chance of launching a peace process with the Afghan government, that it would have to essentially agree to this stipulation in a negotiation that did not involve the Afghan government. Basically, that's where things have come today, where after the convening of a Loya Jirga, essentially a large gathering of tribal leaders in Afghanistan, made a decision to release all of these Taliban prisoners, including the last 400 that were particularly dangerous. But now what we're hearing is the fact that there are some countries that are very worried about the security implications of all of this. So it's really a very complicated story, and it comes down to weighing the costs and benefits of, on the one hand, releasing dozens and even hundreds of very dangerous individuals, and on the other hand, doing that in order to have the best chance of launching a peace process to end the war in Afghanistan.
How strong are the recommendations or the plea to not receive these prisoners from France and some other countries?
I would admit that I was surprised to hear these concerns expressed by France and a few others. I think that the Afghan government has said that it needs to hold off on concluding everything until it gets the consensus of the international community, including the likes of France, which has been concerned. But I do think that at the end of the day, most countries, much of the international community recognizes that this is a very risky move by the Afghan government to release these Taliban prisoners, but that it has to happen in order to have any chance of launching a peace process that the international community, including the French, really want to end. So I imagine that this will not become a major issue, will not become a major obstacle to completing this process of releasing these remaining Taliban prisoners. But certainly I think it underscores just how complicated and risky this whole thing is.
Is there a rift on this between the United States and the Afghan government?
I think that there probably had been earlier on. I think that the U.S. government has been pressuring the Afghan government for quite some time to agree to really essentially speed up and complete this process of releasing all the prisoners. And that's because the U.S. government, the Trump administration, really wants a peace process to begin. It wants there to be a lot of progress made in a peace process as the U.S. removes forces, because for the U.S. government, the optics of pulling so many troops from Afghanistan, which is already happening, are not very positive. If that's happening while at the same time the Taliban is continuing to fight the war and is not sitting for peace talks. So the optics are much better for the U.S. of having this prisoner release process end so that the peace process can begin. But for good reason, the Afghan government wanted to take it slow, particularly because it was not involved in the negotiation that led to this very tricky situation of having to release so many Taliban prisoners. But I do think that now that the Afghan government has made it clear that it is going to complete this process of releasing these Taliban prisoners, I think that will ease any tensions that may have arisen between the U.S. and Afghanistan on this issue.
Michael Kugelman is the Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center, a think tank in Washington.
Are my pets safe from coronavirus? There's no current evidence that cats and dogs can be infected. Hand washing after contact with all animals is recommended. This protects against other bacteria such as E. coli and Salmonella that can pass between animals and humans. For more information, visit the websites at the World Health Organization and the U.S. Centers for Disease and Control. A message from your friends at VOA Asia. VOA Asia Weekend continues. Here's Ira Melman.
The global health crisis has put the dreams of millions of poor Indians aiming to join the ranks of the middle class into an indefinite freeze. For one man, it means he may not be able to put his younger brother through law school. Francis McGuire has more.
Ashish Kumar shares a common dream with millions of Indian workers to escape poverty and join the country's growing middle class. But like many, the 20-year-old's aspirations have been put on hold by the global health crisis. Ashish was a technician with a degree in plastic moulding, a big step for his family who lived most of his life in a mud hut. Until March, Ashish worked 8-hour shifts making boxes for Ferrero Rocher chocolates, earning $173 every month, and he was able to send some of this income home to support his family, including enough to build a proper brick home and put his younger brother into law school. The money stopped coming in, though, when India went into lockdown and Ashish's factory shut down. Now out of work, he's been forced to make the 900-mile return trip home to North India.
The dream that I wanted to realize by the year 2022 or 23 has now been pushed back by 2 to 4 or 5 years. As of now, I cannot do anything for the next 4 to 5 years.
It's estimated at least 10 million people in India returned to the villages they'd left behind when lockdown began. Overall, the International Monetary Fund estimates the country's economy will contract 4.5% this year. Ashish originally planned to save up and build his own recycling factory. Now he, and millions like him, face an uncertain future to see whether their dreams of economic freedom can ever be realized.
That was Reuters' Francis McGuire reporting. According to a report by the Brookings Institution, almost 3 million more firearms have been sold since March, much more than the same period in previous years. It also says there is evidence that people who have never owned guns before are lining up to get one. Elena Wolf has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
Shooting range instructor Sam Barbakov helps unload guns after a busy day at a shooting gallery. Barbakov, who moved to the U.S. from Russia, has always loved firearms. And he's in the right place. Florida is a gun-friendly state. Floridians own 450,000 registered firearms. That's the second highest level of gun ownership in the country, behind Texas. Recently, though, even this gun-loving state has seen a major spike in sales and new gun owners since March. And it's happening all over the U.S. Americans are purchasing guns at record high numbers throughout the country. The National Instant Criminal Background Check System run by the FBI performed over 19 million background checks in the first half of the year. That's 6 million more than in the first half of 2019. According to the Brookings Institution, concerns about personal safety are driving the rise in demand for guns. In March, it says buyers expressed concern about COVID and the economic downturn. More recently, authors of the report say those same fears, plus widespread protests against racial injustice sparked by the death of George Floyd, drove sales. For Elena Wolf in Delray Beach, Florida, NRI's VOA News.
With many of the top stories from the past week, we continue now with VOA Asia Weekend.
In India, the annual monsoon season has led to widespread flooding and other disasters, killing at least 150 people and displacing or affecting nearly 8 million others, from vast rural areas in the north and east to states in the south and west. Experts blame the deadly flooding on climate change and warn that unless more attention is paid to sustainable development, such disasters could worsen in years to come. We hear more from Anjana Pasricha in New Delhi.
This hillside, once a lush tea plantation, collapsed as heavy monsoon rains lashed India's southern Kerala state. Dozens were buried under the rubble.
Our children are no more. We have nobody else left in the world.
In the far north and east, millions grappled with a trail of destruction as rivers, swollen by monsoon rains, inundated farmland, villages and homes in some of India's poorest states, Assam and Bihar. Some built their own rafts to navigate the waters. Relief was slow to come due to the coronavirus pandemic. Rare one-horned rhinos drowned in a wildlife park. Experts warn such large-scale flooding has become an annual feature as climate change alters the pattern of the South Asian monsoon season. Short, intense bursts of rain have become more frequent instead of the steady showers that traditionally rejuvenated thirsty soils.
If you have more than 100 millimeters of rainfall within 24 hours, it's called an extreme rainfall. But the problem now is that we are getting 100 millimeters of rainfall within an hour now. So even the definition of extreme rainfall events will have to change, considering the quantity of rain, the intensity of rainfall that we are experiencing now.
Cities have not been spared the havoc of changing monsoon patterns. In Mumbai, vehicles were submerged and people waded through knee-deep water when the heaviest single-day rainfall in 15 years lashed the city this month. Experts blame the flooding on rapid urbanization that has led to a construction boom in cities in what were traditional drainage areas.
Especially in many of the river fronts or in the cities like in Mumbai, there is number of streams or small rivers called nalas. All these nalas are encroached by various people due to heavy encroachments. So what happens is all the places where the water can go, that is drastically decreased.
The floods are costly catastrophes. They account for nearly two-thirds of the economic losses caused by natural disasters. The damage over three decades is estimated at $50 billion. That is why measures to protect riverfronts and revive lakes and swamps must be prioritized.
The first point is recognizing that there is a problem. The second point is understanding that this problem can be solved in an economically viable manner. It is not expensive.
Experts warn, if the call for addressing climate change and sustainable development goes unheeded, such scenes will continue to ravage the poorest communities. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
VOA Asia Weekend continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. New Zealand is extending a nationwide lockdown after more COVID-19 infections were detected. Four mystery cases diagnosed in Auckland on Tuesday were the first to have been locally transmitted in more than 100 days. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern expects more infections to emerge in the coming days. Auckland is New Zealand's biggest city and will be subject to a Level 3 coronavirus lockdown, while the rest of the country will remain at Level 2. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
A dozen new COVID-19 cases have been detected in New Zealand. In a country where until this week there were no local infections for more than 100 days, this number is significant. A three-day nationwide lockdown due to expire Friday is being extended. The emergency centres on a cluster of cases in Auckland. The origin of the infections is still being investigated. 38 people are in government quarantine. New Zealand's biggest city will remain under Level 3 coronavirus restrictions until later this month at least. Bars, restaurants and schools are shut and most workers forced to stay at home. The rest of New Zealand, a country of 5 million people, is on a Level 2 lockdown in a four-tier alert system, which means public gatherings are limited to 100 people and strangers must physically distance. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern says her cautious approach is warranted as the COVID-19 outbreak gets worse.
It will grow before it slows, and it may continue to be linked to schools, churches and social gatherings as it has done to date. In keeping with our precautionary approach and New Zealand's philosophy of going hard and going early, today Cabinet has agreed to maintain our current settings for an additional 12 days.
Last month, the World Health Organization highlighted New Zealand as an example for having successfully eliminated community transmission. In June, Prime Minister Ardern said the country had united in unprecedented ways to crush the virus. But the new cases are a reminder, even in places where the virus had seemingly vanished, that outbreaks can still happen. New Zealand's international borders remain closed to foreign nationals. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
We're glad to have you with us for VOA Asia Weekend. China was the topic U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo focused on during his trip to Eastern Europe, where he warned leaders in the Czech Republic, Slovenia, and Austria that China's Communist Party poses an even bigger security threat than the former Soviet Union. VOA's diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain has more on Pompeo's trip to Eastern Europe.
On his tour of Eastern Europe, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo sought to strengthen bilateral ties on a range of issues. He acknowledged the unrest in Belarus following contested elections and the arms embargo on Iran. But the threat posed by China's Communist Party and its telecommunications infrastructure was a central thread running through each stop.
I think the whole world can plainly see now that the Chinese Communist Party is intent on using this telecommunications infrastructure for purposes that no other telecom system in the world does, right? They're using it as deeply tied to their national security apparatus, to their intelligence community, to their military forces, all the data.
China has dismissed Pompeo's warnings, saying that wherever he goes, he always spreads, quote, political viruses, quote, and false information. But the warnings about Huawei and others have already borne fruit, with Pompeo signing a joint declaration with Slovenian Foreign Minister Anže Logar that excludes untrusted vendors from 5G networks. One expert told VOA Pompeo's focus on China is having an impact.
I think the administration's leadership on this issue in particular really has helped turn the tide on the question. And I think that more and more countries are going to be falling in line on the issue of Chinese involvement in the next generation telecommunications.
Daniel Kochis told VOA he believes Russia is still a more immediate threat to Central and Eastern Europe than China.
But I think that China still remains somewhat of the longer-term threat here. I think that Russia still, because of the threat of military action, because of propaganda, still is sort of the first and foremost threat to the Central European region.
Another expert agreed that Eastern European countries are facing more immediate and pressing issues than the threat from China and urged a more balanced message.
So at the same time that, yes, China is an important element of our foreign policy, it cannot be the only focus. We have to have a more nimble, more multi-vectored approach to these countries.
Pompeo also consulted with leaders at each stop about the dramatic events in Belarus.
Just as I talked about in the Czech Republic, we want the people of Belarus to have the freedoms that they're demanding, that they think are in their best interests. We watch the protests. We urge that the nonviolent protesters be protected and not harmed.
Austrian Foreign Minister Alexander Schallenberg told reporters the U.S. and the European Union agree that the elections were neither free nor fair. And he said he wants the EU to issue a clear call to Belarus leader Alexander Lukashenko to immediately end the violence and arbitrary detentions and release the remaining prisoners. Cindy Sain, VOA News, Washington.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see with links to find them easily. With VOA Asia, you can also follow radio program host VOA Stevenson and VOA Melman. VOA Asia Twitter. We're always online for you.
We continue with VOA Asia Weekend. No more rallies, handshakes are now passé, and selfie lines lasted just one election cycle. Those are just some of the visible changes in American politics thanks to coronavirus. But coronavirus is causing some more subtle changes that will impact the 2020 election and beyond. VOA's Steve Reddish tells us more.
Staples of the American political landscape are now threatened by the coronavirus pandemic, like voting in person, raucous political rallies, and celebratory conventions.
There's a real debate about whether conventions matter.
People will miss the camaraderie, the collegiality, getting together with people they don't see very often on the convention floor. But I'm just not sure how much that counts for the actual activity of an election campaign.
Harlan Bowman analyzes public opinion at the American Enterprise Institute. Although most Americans still want to vote in person, she says they also want to have the option to vote by mail.
And it turns out historically that people who do vote by mail actually turn in their ballots themselves, which I think is quite interesting overall. But this is new territory.
Primary elections held during the pandemic saw some states able to count absentee mail-in ballots promptly while keeping polling places open and moving. Other states experienced embarrassing delays tabulating and validating votes.
I think, unfortunately, for a lot of people, the requirement to do this happened suddenly. There wasn't a lot of long-term planning to say, hey, what happens if we have a pandemic and everyone is trapped in their house? It's just not something people were thinking about. But now they have to do it quickly, and if they're going to be effective, they have to do it right on the first try.
President Donald Trump has seized on scattered and rare instances of fraud in voting by mail, saying it should not be expanded.
I think what he spurred is that, you know, Democratic voters seem much more likely to want to vote by mail than Republican voters, and you know that does set up some perverse incentives for Republicans.
Kyle Condick analyzes elections for Sabato's Crystal Ball at the University of Virginia Center for Politics. He says Americans will miss a basic element of campaigning this year.
So much of being a politician is it's sort of a tactile profession, in that, you know, you're shaking hands, giving people hugs, you know, interacting closely with people. I think Joe Biden, sometimes to his detriment, he's sort of sometimes been accused of being a little too touchy-feely, basically, in his interactions with people. But he's known as being kind of a warm person and someone who gets up close to people. And he just can't do that.
Clearly, the Trump campaign appears to be concentrating still on in-person contacts. We've certainly seen the Biden campaign being much more of the basement mentality, working very heavily digitally. And it remains to be seen what works. I mean, I'm not so sure I would open a door to a stranger at this point.
A tiny virus has transformed the 2020 campaign, changing politics as we knew it. Steve Reddish, VOA News, Washington.
There is no current evidence that dogs can be infected. Hand washing after contact with all animals is recommended. This protects against other bacteria, such as E. coli and Salmonella, that can pass between animals and humans. For more information, visit www.who.int or www.cdc.gov.
Now on VOA Asia Weekend, the list of U.S. retailers that have filed for bankruptcy this year is long and varied. They range from those selling inexpensive and off-brand goods to century-old name brands that have catered to the rich and famous. Industry experts say many were struggling before the pandemic, which proved to be the final blow. But filing for bankruptcy protection could help save some of them, as we hear from VOA's Mariama Diallo.
Lord & Taylor recently joined a long list of U.S. retailers hit hard by stay-at-home orders spawned by the coronavirus pandemic. Launched in 1824, the department store found in dozens of American shopping malls recently filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection.
And it arguably was the straw that broke the camel's back. Another way to look at this is the pandemic and the associated economic recession accelerated what was already occurring in the industry. We had several retail bankruptcies before the pandemic, and others were teetering on the edge, but were trying to forestall bankruptcy.
Months of shutdown in response to the pandemic caused merchandise sales from brick-and-mortar stores to fall precipitously. But Brian Marks says this could present an opportunity for these large operations to transform.
If we look at the major ones of JCPenney J. Crew, Neiman Marcus, Brooks Brothers, and Lord & Taylor, these are all very strategic moves for this industry to right-size and transform its cost structure. All these operations had significant debt and significant lease liability on the real estate side, except for Lord & Taylor.
Mary Ebner, co-founder of Reagent NYC, a retail analysis group, says Chapter 11 is not a death sentence. To the contrary, it's a tool to reorganize, restructure debt, and embark on a new business strategy.
And you can evaluate your management, your supply chain, your vendor mix, your leases, and the leases become an important topic here.
With numerous locations, stores need revenue to pay their rent in order to stick to their lease contracts. That became hard with the prolonged public health crisis.
Lord & Taylor, maybe 45 locations. J. Crew, close to 500 locations. JCPenney, over 800 locations. They enter into leases for real estate to provide their bricks and mortar operations.
JCPenney is another iconic department store chain that also filed for bankruptcy. The store that started over 100 years ago had nearly 85,000 employees before a reorganization that will see it close about a third of its nearly 850 stores nationwide.
And what's going to happen? I just did a quick count of how many stores JCPenney is planning to close. I believe it's something like almost 160 stores. And 160 stores, they probably have anywhere from 150 to 200 people per store. It's a pretty staggering amount.
Closing mall-based department stores affects every business that shares the mall space.
And it causes a ripple effect throughout the mall, because insofar as customers are still shopping JCPenney, they're coming there and then they're possibly going to a Gap, a Victoria's Secret, a Bath & Body Works, or whatever. So it really hurts. And think about it, if you have a JCPenney and a Lord & Taylor in a mall and they're both closing, it can be pretty shocking and devastating.
Both Ebner and Marks say not all employees will lose their jobs, but there may be a transformation with not so much direct customer service in the store, but more online or in a warehouse for distribution purposes. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
A research mission that launched into space more than a decade ago continues to bear ample fruit for scientists on Earth. What began as an operation to learn the origins of our solar system is yielding additional exciting discoveries. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has The Week in Space.
4, 3, 2, main engine start. 1, 0, and liftoff of the...
NASA's Dawn spacecraft mission, launched in 2007, continues to make discoveries. The latest, announced by NASA this week, a saltwater reservoir about 40 kilometers beneath the surface of Ceres, a dwarf planet some 4.5 billion years old that survived the earliest days of our solar system. The aim of the 2007 mission was to study an asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. In 2015, after examining a giant asteroid named Vesta, Dawn visited Ceres. It ran out of its primary fuel in October 2018, and NASA placed it in orbit to keep it from crashing into anything. NASA currently has no plans to revisit Ceres, but Dawn remains the only spacecraft to orbit the two extraterrestrial destinations.
Ignition. And liftoff.
In other news, fresh off a successful round-trip visit to the International Space Station, SpaceX launched a Falcon 9 rocket from Cape Canaveral carrying 57 Starlink satellites.
You can see the video just came back here of them floating away into space.
The satellites join hundreds of others already in orbit. SpaceX plans to build a 12,000 satellite mega constellation to beam broadband internet from space to Earth. Finally, these images taken from orbit above Earth show what is believed to be the Yongbyon Nuclear Scientific Research Center near the Kuryong River in North Korea. The pictures suggest recent flooding may have damaged pump houses connected to the country's main nuclear facility. Experts say the images show the area's vulnerability to extreme weather events. Yongbyon is about 100 kilometers north of Pyongyang and home to the facilities thought to be used in the country's nuclear weapons program. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
This has been VOA Asia Weekend, a compilation of some of the stories presented throughout the past week on our daily VOA Asia program. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Check out VOA Asia online at voanews.com.